Okay, we'll continue forging ahead. Mindfulness of breathing. with mindfulness of breathing, I gave some kind of basic tools or basic guidelines. Things that can be used in conjunction with the breath in addition to the actual structure of the sutta, and that are common practices, certainly in Thailand. The most common meditation tool is buddho, using the word buddho, and which is the name of the Buddha, and that's it's just an idiosyncrasy of the Pali and the way that the Thais use Pali. So it's buddho, and sort of as a name, and so they'll use that. They use it in many ways, but sort of in conjunction with the breath. Just using that word buddho on the in breath, put on the out breath, to. So it's using the name of the Buddha, and then what it's doing is engaging the discursive part of the mind, but narrowing it down to one word. And that's helpful because we usually just don't do one word in discursive thought. It usually starts spinning out in all sorts of different directions. So it helps to sustain that focus. So that you're using that awareness to pay attention to the breath. As a breath comes in, paying attention to it, but then conjoining it to that recitation of Bud, so that paying attention, okay, as the in-breath begins, then you're beginning that Bud on the out-breath. So it's actually quite a handy way of helping to sustain attention on the breath and to create that continuity of awareness. One is just using the word of the name of the Buddha, so it's a devotional object as well. It can be, or a recollection. I remember a Thai monk, somebody asking him. Can we use anything else other than buddho? He said, "Well, sure, you can use anything you like. I mean, so you can do anything that's two syllables. You can do Pepsi if you like, but it doesn't have doesn't elicit the same feeling." So that sense of you're eliciting a certain feeling the Buddha, and then also. Because one can bring up that recollection of what the word Buddha literally means, being the one who knows, the one who's awakened, the one who is bright, and that's a reminder of the qualities that we're trying to bring to the attention of each in breath and each out breath. So that's a useful tool to employ, and similarly, just by as the mind begins to settle, and then the actual quality of knowing becomes stronger, then one doesn't need to be reciting it. I mean, the actual quality is there, so. It's not essential that it be recited, so that it's fulfilled its purpose, and then to settle into the knowing, of the breath. So that again, these are there's a continuum of attention and awareness and reflection that is actually taking place. It isn't, because sometimes we can be kind of hold to it fearfully in the sense of, oh, I've got to hold my butto, got to keep it going, otherwise I'm not really practicing. And but then it's at a certain point, as the mind begins to settle, awareness becomes more continuous, that the recitation of butto starts to clutter the mind, and then it itself is the obstacle. So you need to be paying attention to, okay, what the quality of the mind is and what the goal is, because the goal is clarity, peace, knowledge, understanding, and the tools that we are employing should be supports for getting us there. So that sense of using the butto in conjunction with the breath. Another tool that is helpful sometimes with especially when at the beginning when the mind might be restless or you're not ready to settle, then using counting so that you're paying attention to the in breath and out breath, but you can employ counting, and there's many different ways to do it. My own preference that I've used is using the counting in a way that helps to kind of challenge the mind in the sense of, okay, on the in-breath one, on the out-breath one, on the in-breath two, on the out-breath two, and then go up to five, and then come back. On the in-breath one, out-breath one, up to six. And, but also, again, they say, okay, we're sort of up the ante a bit. If the mind wanders, you have to start from scratch. So sometimes it's hard to get to five. You've got the sensation of the breath, you've got the counting that is happening, so it provides a mirror for saying, okay, is there distracting thoughts happening, is there kind of moods that are kind of taking over the mind, so that it helps to clarify that, to see it more clearly, and then to relinquish it, and so that and then you know, say 1 to 6, 1 to 7, 1 to 8, 1 to 9, 1 to 10, 1 to 9, 1 to 8, 1 to 7, 1 to 6, 1 to 5. You know, so you want to be kind of mixing it up a bit, so you know whether or not you're losing it, because sometimes in breath put out breath in breath put out breath put out, you can sort of pay attention, you've got in breath put out going, and then you're thinking about all sorts of other things quite happily. So you know, we get, you know, it's just the nature of the mind. I mean, our minds can be extraordinarily adept at distractions. It's like the most obvious one for me is, or the, you know, I've seen in my mind is like the recitation of the Patimokkha. It's about a 45 to 50 minute recitation of our rules of training. It's about 45, 50 pages of Pali. and you recite it quite fast so that you're not torturing your fellow monks by taking too long. And it has to be letter perfect so that somebody is listening, and it has to be letter perfect so that if you, you know, miss a word, miss a vowel, then they'll stop and correct you. And I've certainly seen in my own mind where, you know, actually reciting it properly, correctly, good flow going, where it's, I'm not missing anything, and still thinking of something else. So, you know, it's just, you know, this is why the mind needs training. So that all the tools that we can employ are really, really helpful. And so that sense of these little kind of tools and tricks and that help the mind to stay on track, like I was saying with the first part of the using awareness to go through the body while you're breathing in, breathing out, and then just paying attention to a sensation, just imagining a sensation at the top of the head, and then breathing in, breathing out, just sort of really feeling across the forehead. Breathing in, breathing out, feeling around the eyes. Is it relaxed? Is it attentive? Now, what's the posture like? Really going through that around the mouth. Around the jaw, as we can be, sort of breathing in, breathing out, peaceful, relaxed, and our jaws are sort of clenched. You say, "Oh, that's not relaxed at all." And it's when you recognize, "Oh, right, there it is." That's actually, how can I release that? How can I relax that? Paying attention to the kind of the balance of the body, bringing awareness into the body. So as you're breathing in, breathing out, okay, my shoulders, are they relaxed? Are they comfortable? Am I leaning forward? Am I leaning back? Going too tight? Do I have a? And sometimes that's where, like, using a cushion is really helpful, unless you've got a really quite flexible body with very good posture, then it's helpful to have a cushion to lift up the back and keep a little bit of an arch in the pelvis, so that there's a... 'cause if one's sitting flat, or even if one's sitting with a cushion, and then the knees go up, and then there's a sort of a slump like this, and then it gets, it's tiring to hold the body, and then you start to feel all sorts of aches and pains, which are mostly tension, because of a lack of balance. In Thailand, at Wat Pa Pong in particular, they didn't exist. They weren't. These were our meditation mats. that was it. And it was kind of, and in the old days, it was concrete floors. Now they have marble. So, and uh, that uh, But having a cushion, it helps to get just getting the right height, and you have to experiment so that the you come forward a little bit. There's a little bit of a tilt to the pelvis. There's a little bit of an arch at the small of the back, and then it rises up from the pelvis. Arms are kind of loose at the side, and there's a balance there. And as that, you pay attention to that quality of balance, then the sitting posture becomes comfortable. And what is also comfortable with that quality of balance is the breathing. If you're kind of hunched, then the breathing's kind of constricted. You want to be able to be breathing from the belly, not sort of, but it's just as a letting the breath really come down into the body, letting it go out and arising, and there's a relaxation that comes through the whole body that way, and it also, that kind of quality of balance helps to energize the whole system, really. So that that mindfulness of breathing it's starting to encompass all the aspects of mind and body. And that's where the sense of bringing a sense of ease, very consciously bringing a kind of relaxation and well-being into the breath, and that's where the next when the Buddha structure of mindfulness of breathing, the next aspect or next tetrad. Is on the tetrad around vedana or feeling, and the Buddha immediately comes in with paying attention to pleasant feeling, in the sense of training oneself. I'll breathe in sensitive or experiencing rapture, the Pali word beti. There's a sense of rapture, and training oneself to breathe out, sensitive to rapture, experiencing rapture. On one level, it may be the result of having paid attention to the body and gone through the first tetrad, and mind just sort of drops into concentration, and then one starts experiencing rapture and joy. It may not happen that way. That was something that was really, really frustrating with Ajahn Chah, because he'd oftentimes give instruction. It's like there's and it would, he, for him, it just seemed to be so straightforward. And there's and this is just an example, and it came, I can remember so often, he would just say, yeah, you breathe in and out, you know, sort of like, and yeah, there's no need to think anything special, just concentrate on this simple task for now, breathing. Having continuous presence of mind, there's nothing more to do, just breathing in and out. Soon the mind becomes peaceful, the breath refined. Mind and body becomes light. This is the right state for the work of meditation. that was his experience. It didn't seem to be our experience, the rest of the Western students. But... There is, but there certainly is this possibility, and it's like the one, yeah, it can be the result, but two, one can actually, you know, what comes into being is also, you know, what we attend to, so that if we start paying attention to every little feeling of discomfort, every little itch, every little a bit of tightness here. Oh, that's there. Oh, my knees are starting to hurt a little bit. Then that becomes more and more predominant. It's because you pay attention to it. You give it attention. But you can also, in breathing in, you know, really an in-breath and an out-breath is a neutral sensation. There's no, you know, there's not that much happening there. But we can also imbue it with a certain quality of joy, of rapture. It doesn't have to be dazzling or spectacular, but just, yeah, there's this pleasant, there's a feeling of, oh yeah, this feels good, this feels right. This is really something. Wow, I'm really fortunate to be able to have the time and the faculties and the circumstances to be able to sit and pay attention to one breath coming in, one breath going out. And you start to generate a feeling of rapture. And I said, it doesn't have to, light show type rapture. It's just it feels good, and you can by paying attention to that, generating attention around, it starts to kick in, and it's not, you know, on a certain level, yeah, it is contrived, but it's not. It's more like. Making a conscious choice of paying attention or supporting a feeling that is one of well-being, rather than a feeling of, wow, this is so difficult. This is really if you look at it, yeah, it is difficult to pay attention to one in-breath and one out-breath and sustain it. Oh yeah, this is. Rigorous, boring, it's all of those things. But if we give that attention, that's what gains traction. If we give attention in a way that is, that can be quite easeful. It opens up possibilities of well-being. And that's what bhīti is that. Moving toward well-being and rapture, and as it starts to kick in, it can gain more momentum, because the mind actually it feels better, than the attention that we give to the unpleasant or the difficult. Similarly, that the training oneself, I'll breathe in, experiencing pleasure. This is sukha, and bhīti is more of a mental joy, and sukha, you still experience it in the body, but it's more predominantly a mental joy. Experience. Sukha is translated as pleasure, happiness, tends to be predominantly physical. It's not so kind of, say, excited as bhīti. So it's a so it has a tendency to can really deeply relax the body, as well as experience that sense of pleasure. The next step in that the Buddha gives in this tetrad on Vedana, on feeling, is training oneself, I'll breathe in, sensitive to or experiencing mental fabrication. See, in the previous one, it was bodily fabrication. This is mental fabrication. Jitta sankhara. And breathing out, experiencing sensitive to mental fabrication. And then the last step, but training oneself, breathe in, calming mental fabrication. Training oneself, I'll breathe out, calming mental fabrication. And it's important to recognize that when the Buddha defines citta sankhara, mental conditioners or mental fabrications, mental constructions, the basic building block of these citta sankhara is feeling and perception. Those two, and those aren't, those, how do you say, the thought process involves the thought process, the emotional process of citta sankhara involves volition. We invest a volition and intention in it, whether it's conscious or not. I mean, there's an investment in it. We make a choice. Whereas feeling and perception are fundamental to the mental processes of the mind. It's precognizant, verbal, pre-volition. What we can do is observe. We can watch. We can see clearly, and it's in that experiencing sensitive to that building of the mental fabrications that we're able to calm it. And again, that's where the breath is really helpful, because as we calm our breathing, have an anchor for being attentive to this fabricating process, this constructing process, then well, we start to get a handle on it. Not by forcing it or controlling it or by an act of will to suppress it, but when it's seen clearly, then yeah, the choices are fairly simple. In that sense, do I want to suffer, or do I want to feel at ease? And usually we don't have that luxury. We're swept up in the process, so that's where this investigation and using the mindfulness of breathing with the on that level of feeling and the citta sankhara is really important, because we see how these constructs of mind come up out of pretty fundamental building blocks. They're not, it's not so intimidating or confusing when it's seen clearly. Doesn't mean it's going to stop immediately, but the kind of the mystique or the mystery around it is gone. What is it, like the Wizard of Oz when he said, "Oh well, this is no big deal." pull away the curtains, and it's not there's nothing much going on. And the next section that the Buddha gives is on the section of mind, following that template of the four foundations of mindfulness, and similarly that say training oneself, I'll breathe in, sensitive to experiencing the mind. I'll breathe out, sensitive or experiencing the mind. And when we say the mind, it's more, you have to come back to how the Buddha describes the mind in the four foundations of mindfulness. Because it's more like the mood of the mind, or it's not like the details and the characteristics, but it's more like that. When the four foundation of mind, when the Buddha describes mind, it's like what we need: knowing the mind with greed as the mind with greed, knowing the mind without greed as the mind without greed, knowing the mind with anger as the mind with anger, knowing the mind without anger as the mind without anger, knowing the mind with delusion as a mind with delusion. You don't have to sort of analyze it, pick it all apart. It's sort of, oh, that's what a deluded mind does. And then, oh, this is mind without delusion. This is what I see clearly. Knowing the scattered mind as a scattered mind, knowing the settled mind as a settled mind, knowing an expanded mind as an expanded mind, knowing a contracted mind as a contracted mind. So it's more like the mood tone of the mind itself, rather than going down the rabbit hole and getting into all of all of the nuances of thought and feeling and projection and all that. You don't just sort of that. Oh no, this is what greed does to a mind. Oh, this is what expansive mind feels like. Okay, so that sense of experiencing that mood tone of the underlying mood of the mind. And then the next one is trains himself breathing, satisfying the mind, training oneself to breathe out, satisfying the mind. The Pali is abhipamoja. Pamoja is delight. And so that delighting the mind. Anybody remember any other translations for this? Gladdening, yes. Yeah. Gladdening the mind is I think that's how Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it. So satisfying the mind, gladdening the mind. So that you're starting to get seeing a theme happening here, where the Buddha is encouraging us to pay attention to these positive, wholesome states of well-being. On a certain level, it's always, because sometimes we get hooked into the kind of bad PR that Buddhism is all about suffering. forget to recognize that the Buddha's constantly, suffering definitely is the point of reflection and investigation. But the path of practice is grounded in happiness and well-being. And so that, you know, whether it's, you think of all of the factors of the Eightfold Path, there isn't any of those factors that an encouragement to suffer more. It's all ways of living, practicing, training for increasing well-being and decreasing suffering. And similarly, mindfulness of breathing. There's this very overt, conscious necessity to foster this quality of well-being. Part of it is the, again, the sort of the very overt statement by the Buddha is that the happy mind is easily concentrated. And it's a sort of, yeah, right. And it's like when, what is it? Yeah, time goes by quickly when you're having a good time. And it's the same, you know, in meditation, when you're really, you're settled and enjoying and at ease, boom, the bell rings real quick. And the opposite is quite true. when's that bell going to go? Satisfying the mind, gladdening the mind, delighting the mind, making it conscious. And then the next one, training oneself, a breathing, steadying the mind, concentrating the mind. I don't like that word very much, but it's usually how it's translated. Ajahn Jeff does a good job of avoiding concentrating, using steadying, settling the mind, so bringing the mind to a place of stability. So that breathing in, really paying attention to that quality of steadiness, settling, stability, balance. It's really getting your roots down firm in that well-being and stability. And then training oneself, the last encouragement in this tetrad is around the training oneself of breathing, releasing the mind, releasing the mind that still clings to the either to the say the hindrances that obstruct the peaceful meditation or the concentration, or releasing the mind from the deeper roots of defilement and attachment, and been recognizing. And you start to see, these are integrating. It isn't as if it's a linear, you got to do one step one, and then when you get that down, then you can do step two. And then after some time, once you've got step two down, then you can do step three. It's not really like that. These are working together. They're feeding and supporting each other. And you just have to be experimenting with what works, what's helpful, what seems relevant, what seems interesting at any given time. It's helpful to have those structures. I've certainly used these structures in meditation to, actually memorizing it, both the English, then memorizing the Pali, because once you get a good feel for it, what the word, the constellation of meanings that a Pali word has, then it elicits a memory of, okay, this is what I want to do. But then using these steps to remind myself of what to do, what to keep doing, rather than it just being nebulous, breathe in, breathe out, merge with the universe, and, you know, which is, you know, usually kind of either a state of confusion or just drowsiness and dullness. Because there does need to be a sharpening of the mind, a sharpening of attention, in order for a strength of mind or a steadiness of mind to build up. So these steps are really helpful in supporting that. The last tetrad tends to be what is more referred to as the sort of the insight practices or the aspects of the say of Dhamma, the section related to Dhamma or phenomena, and how we relate to phenomena and to Dhamma. But the first one, training myself, breathe in, focusing on inconstancy, impermanence, anicca. Anicca anupasi, which is, Ajahn Jeff says, focusing on, contemplating is choosing words is sometimes, because contemplating can be a bit too discursive and proliferating. Focusing can be a bit too much like concentrating. But anyway, there's anupasi is more like, there's one's attention is there, but there's a reflective quality. Any sense of the root of the Pali word? Investigate. Pasi is to, because pasi is to see. It's sort of same as say pasana, or the same one. So it's to see, and anu is sort of seeing things, teasing things apart a bit, and reflecting. And all of these are, that's the verb for all of this whole tetrad. This is reflecting, contemplating, focusing, attentive to. So anicca, so inconstancy, uncertainty. I gave a whole talk on that last night. And the second one of this tetrad is breathing in, focusing on or reflecting on. The Pali word is viraga, and it literally, dispassion, but it also has the meaning of fading away, I like dispassion. But it's helpful, I think, to recognize that dispassion is a fading away rather than a rejecting or a fear of something. It's like they say, it's just like there's a cooling of the heart that one can't get too excited about it anymore. next one is training oneself, I'll breathe in, focusing on, reflecting on cessation. same breathing out, to this cessation. And the Pali word is nirodha, and the word cessation, it's hard to translate nirodha anyway else. Cessation is a good translation, but the connotation in English is a bit too black and white, in the sense of cessation of a of an arisen thing, and which sometimes it can be that, where, yeah, the breath comes in, there's a cessation of the in-breath. The breath goes out, and there's a cessation of the out-breath. A thought arises in the mind, and there's a cessation of that thought, a cessation of a feeling. But, and it's helpful to see that, because the the tendency of the mind is to go to becoming all the time, being, experiencing, is moving towards. So, but in contemplating and recognizing the natural tone of the ending of things, it's like when we pay attention to the end of the breath or the end of a thought, there really is that cessation. There's a relief. There's a peacefulness that's there. That's really helpful. But it's also, that word nirodha can also mean non-arising. And that has a different kind of tone. It's like, because we don't have to wait for, say, ignorance or anger to arise in order to watch it cease. You can actually pay attention to its non-arising. You can start saying, oh, there's no desire there. Well, this is what it feels like when there's no desire. There's non-arising of desire. There's non-arising of confusion. There's non-arising. So, and it's, oh, that's opens up a whole realm of possibilities. And so that's a really beautiful area of investigation. So that sense of both the inherent peacefulness of the cessation, but then the possibilities of non-arising. So both of them are encompassed in this quality of nirodha. Mm-hmm. And we can be doing it in breath and out breath. The very last one is relinquishment. Pali word is patinisaga. So training oneself, or breathe in, focusing on, reflecting on relinquishment. And, of course, there's all the areas of relinquishment, letting go, releasing. But primarily, that word patinisaga is a relinquishing of self, a relinquishing of the I position, the me, the mine, a kind of demon that latches on, grabs you by the throat and drags you around. So just being able to not have to carry that burden of that I, me, and mine. So that that sense of experiment you've got with these 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing. With all the little kind of nuances and little other techniques, it's just mindfulness and breathing is just incredibly rich, and You know, it really is a complete path, so that to be able to take an interest in it and to learn how to use it. So again, I can keep on talking for a long time, but there's not much point. And just see if anybody has any questions. Jonathan.
Could we translate sati as recognizing?
Sati, recognizing.
Recognizing the body as a body as a body.
You could, but it's helpful to. That's where it's actually helpful to see the ways that how the Buddha used the words like sati, sampajanya, different nuances of how awareness is fostered. So sati, recognizing. I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, because sati has its roots in, just the word itself has its roots in memory. So that recognizing is sort of a recognizing and remembering. So it has, it's a valid way of speaking about it. And but it is helpful to have a constellation of words that we can describe that experience of sati, because the English language is we have to develop a familiarity with the terminologies in order to start to see what the Buddha is pointing to. Yes.
When you're talking about watching fading away, these things that they're happening anyway, and we're learning to see them.
Yes, that's true.
And yeah. Because I started gardening, and I see, I'll walk down the street and I'll see, out of the corner of my eye, I'll see a plant and I'll know what it is.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Before I started gardening, I didn't see it, and I'm thinking that maybe it's the same sort of thing that we're training ourselves to be sensitive to this.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that it's there, but we just don't have the eyes to see.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's very much like that. Yeah, learning. Because it's another aspect of learning. And tuning in.
And I think a way that I tend to make things harder for myself. I think I'm going to... Some big projection or something.
Yes, yes, yeah.
And
usually... You and a lot of other people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's the... that's why I think it's say somebody like Ajahn Chah, that was one of his skills, was being able to express the Dhamma in a way that actually simplified it rather than complicated it. For us to encourage ourselves to do the same thing. Certainly the Buddha also tended to keep things, keep on task. Suffering, end of suffering. it's really, really, because the tendency of the mind to proliferate, to project, to kind of pontificate, to whatever, it just keeps getting more and more complicated, to doubt, to worry, all of that, and keeps getting in the way. Yeah, Karina.
Just making sure, seeing if I understand clearly the
modulating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Controlling.
Yeah. I'm trying to find a word that doesn't overtly, because you're in there doing stuff, but you don't want to be controlling, but you do want to experiment and modulate. Let's try it this way. Oh, that's not working. Let's try it that way. Ooh, that's better. You know, so it's you're modulating. It's just a word of experimenting with words to see what works. Because the tendency to control is sometimes kind of visceral.
And what comes up for me is that my mind goes away and I'm lost, in some story or something. But if I sit still and don't move, eventually when I come back, I realize the body is really settled and I can get into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so for me, it just seems like they're separate. I know they're not, but the mind and the body I use.
Well, sometimes they don't communicate with each other. when they do, then they can be mutually supportive.
I was looking at the degrees perhaps being a degree difference between modulating and controlling. Mm-hmm. And modulating is more subtle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does it relate to what you said? Is, where you put your attention as it grows?
Yes. Yeah, and sort of recognizing, what is it? What's actually growing? What's the result? Because all action has a result. And so that they're learning how to be more conscious and clear of how we, because thought and attention is an action. It's a mental action, but it has a result. Okay. Shall?
How, in your life, in your daily life, how often do you employ a conscious, if you're not involved in discursive thinking, how often do you employ mindfulness of breathing or for yourself in that moment of daily life, or has it over all these years come so naturally to you that when you're doing a particular task at hand, you're already doing that? How much volition are you still using?
It's pretty natural these days. So that there tends to be a grounding in the body and an anchoring, which is sometimes I have to remind myself, but oftentimes it's just a natural, it's how it works. That's how the system works. Yeah, it's like a default option these days, more and more, because it's where you put your attention has a result, and you do it for over 40 years, and it works.
I was wondering something that I think you gave, it was either a reflection or a Dhamma talk on not too long ago, about how, we're practicing being happy and that we get so caught up in the progress and, we want to be concentrated for this long, but if you come out of meditation less focused than you may have wanted to, that, you might walk away even in a worse state than when you started to meditate. And that's kind of what I've been reflecting on a little before you said that, but then when you said that, it was like, oh, I'm on the right track. Ajahn Pasama said what I was thinking about. So I was just wondering, how can you keep that spirit of, you know, kind of ease and supporting yourself, even though, you know, it's still, there is sort of a spirit of naturally that we want to accomplish these techniques. Mm-hmm. So maybe explain the balance between the two a little bit and then some ways to stay on a more positive side.
Yeah, and I think that's where I find really bringing up the Buddha's teaching, like these structures that the Buddha gives us are quite overt reminders of how to stay on the path. So like, the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing, they'll get you grounded again. Bringing up the seven factors of enlightenment, bringing up the Four Noble Truths, bringing up the five spiritual powers. So, you know, they're spiritual faculties. So, you know, they're templates that help to remind us they're structures, but they give us reminders of an attitude and how to hold it as well. That's where the teachings of the Buddha, or the teachings of course, for me, you know, Ajahn Chah's, it's always reverberating, or just, you know, listening to readings of Ajahn Chah, and just remind me of all sorts of teachings that I've heard, remembered, and a tone as well. So that's important. So it's like that's where that recollections of Dhamma are important. Because sometimes we can be striving and trying too hard, which isn't licensed to sort of goof off, but it's you want to pay attention to balance, and then as soon as we bring in somebody like the Buddha, then there isn't any more balanced being on the planet. So all right, that's where I want to be going.
Posture.
Yeah.
Marie, if you could offer any encouragement or suggestions about if you've been sitting for an extended period of time and the body and the mind are just getting tired.
Yeah.
Maybe too tired to walk, too tired to stand. Mm-hmm. You don't want to lay down because you get a little bit more sati.
Mm-hmm.
Just wondering, personally, when if I lean forward, crumple down, it just spirals down. You know.
Yeah.
Lose mindfulness.
Yeah.
Just wondering about leaning back or a fit posture, some transition between something that's more relaxing than straight upright, but not totally lined up.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of ways in between. You have to pay attention to because leaning. It can be supportive, or it cannot be. I mean, in the sense that, especially like these days, with my kind of pain in my hip and my pelvis, then sometimes I'll be, just sitting like this. Yeah, it gets very painful. I got this really nice comfortable chair in my kuti, and so I'll go and sit in my comfortable chair and start paying attention to breath coming in, breath going out, and I've drifted off because it's a bit too comfortable. But so you really have to pay attention So it's there's a you know, there's a point where, you know, you can't just be pushing yourself all the time, either mentally or physically. But then you also have to pay attention to what is it that I don't know how to, like I found with sitting up at my kuti, I mean, I've got a nice comfortable chair, but still I need another layer of a cushion underneath, cushion behind that helps the back be straighter, so it's actually really upright, and that makes a big difference. So it's just sort of paying attention to those little nuances, and also sometimes like standing meditation is certainly a valid posture to be experimenting with.
Just came up to me that when you were reading, I think it's a discourse that recognizing breath is short, like when it's long and short, or contemplating it during meditation, when you said you said contemplating who's thinking, who's breathing, reflecting. So I'm not clear, how's it different from thinking, you know, and why wouldn't it generate more thought? Like, why would I want to do that?
Yeah.
If I'm trying to, you know. Okay.
It's a great question. Because you have to pay attention to the results. Because sometimes, it's like planting those seeds of reflection. What you're doing is trying to look at your experience from a different angle, and then trying to tease apart the assumptions that we have. So that what it should do is then help them clarify one's attention and then a sense of understanding starts to help to foster increased understanding of our body mind complex, if it's just creating, if it's just random thinking or just proliferating thought or speculative thought, the nature of that kind of thought is that it keeps moving, and then it has an agitating quality to it. It's restless. Whereas when you're using thought as a reflective device, it has a settling quality. It has a sharpening quality. What you're doing is sharpening attention, as opposed to spinning the mind out more. So that you have to pay attention to the result, and that's, you're seeing, okay, what works and what doesn't work, because you're using thought to settle the mind, rather than indulging in thought to agitate the mind.
So it's sort of like an insight. And then peacefulness.
Yeah, there's a peacefulness, or there's a, even if the mind is, because the mind can still think and be peaceful. What a concept! It's really, so that's when it's, and it can be, that's where it helps to shine light on one's experience. But if it's not, in the sense of it's just generating more thinking, more movement, more restlessness, then you have to pay more attention to what is it that helps to settle. So again, that word balance is really important. Okay, let's have a bit of time to sit quietly. We'll be ending the day with a short meditation. And then we'll do a dedication of merit. So we could maybe end with the dedication of blessings. It's in the chanting book, page 27, is it? Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun, the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain a threefold bliss and realize the deathless through the goodness that arises from my practice. And through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, and surpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. Okay, that's it for another Upasaka day.
So I think our next Upasaka day is sometime on the first weekend of December. It'll be the last one of the year.
It'll be the last one of the year. I can't remember when it is.
Is it personality year?
Yeah, December 7th. Daily life practice, Sakaya Ditti. Yeah, identity view. So in daily life practice, bringing awareness of the first fetter into our lives, in the crucible of the holiday season, in meetings with family, friends, and colleagues. Sounds great to me. Don't miss it.